Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Full of Energy, an AEE podcast. The Association of Energy Engineers, otherwise known as AEE, is a professional organization of over 17,000 members and 25,000 certified individuals in over 100 countries. AEE serves your needs for career development, networking, and recognition. Today, we are working to solve all of the world's climate problems by talking about transitioning to decarbonization. Today, we have Gina Anon and Ron Miller on with us, both really great AEE professionals and experts in their field. Gina lives, eats, and breathes decarbonization. She's been a board member for our Council on Women in Energy and Environmental Leadership, heavily involved in workforce development, and even a member of ASHRAE's task force for building decarbonization. Ron is an energy expert with both a CEM and REP certification from AEE, and he heavily volunteers to give webinars, write articles, and spreading the good word of decarbonization. So, Gina, what is the difference between decarbonization and electrification?
First of all, thank you so much for the amazing introduction. I'm really happy to be on board and being part of the AEE has been like amazing experience for me, and contributing to it feels really privileged. So first of all, I'd like to highlight on the fact that electrification and minimization of off-site fossil fuel consumption is really important. The carbon neutral buildings minimizing or eliminating of on-site natural gas and other fossil fuels is really important because of the fossil fuel consumption that directly contributes to the greenhouse gases and emissions. The building electrification combined with energy efficiency can together reduce the air pollution and assist with the better grid management and permanently lower the utility expenses. So the critical considerations that come to my mind are energy efficient equipment, high capacity electrical panels, electrical chases and country runs for future renewables and electric vehicles, electrical outlets near gas equipment. So the electric powered building technologies, they deliver the same level of thermal comfort of traditional gas equipment with lower emissions, and they're often more efficient than other counterparts. And these include heat pump, water heaters, and space heating, including stoves and fireplaces. So as the grid becomes cleaner, the building technologies that do not rely on the gas fuel will become more important to mitigate the carbon and other greenhouse gas emissions. And electrification-ready buildings incorporate high capacity of electrical panels, electrical chases, and conduit runs, and locate electrical outlets near gas equipment for future equipment conversions, inclusive of EV, solar, domestic hot water. All electric buildings support a clean energy future as operational greenhouse gas emissions, and this will be eliminated when the grid supply 100% renewables.
Ron, do you have anything to add to that about decarbonization and electrification?
Yeah, I think the decarbonization, as Gina's really, really eloquently said, is taking the fossil fuels out of our energy mix or energy diet. So things that we can do to reduce that. And one of them, the first step is to use less energy. How can we be more efficient? How can we be a better steward of the environment to lower our electricity? Because every megawatt hour of electricity has an emissions factor of so many tons of CO2 per megawatt hour. So less megawatt hours, less emissions. And I think as we look forward to the decarbonization, the drivers is this electrification, where we're using fossil fuels to in machinery to find ways to electrify that. It could be, in the mining industry, it could be electric-driven trucks, haul trucks, electric-driven conveyors versus haul trucks. So things that we can do to take hydrocarbons out using electricity, especially, and I guess preemptively, if that electricity is a lower emitting source of energy, whether it be solar, wind, geothermal, hydro, probably doesn't make a lot of sense to reduce a diesel engine and replace it with electricity that's generated by, guess what, another diesel engine. So I think it's a little common sense, but I think that's the drivers that we ought to be going toward decarbonization.
Yeah, I agree. So what areas of focus do you think should be targeted for significant carbon reduction?
We have to have a mentality of waste not, want not. So if we want decarbonization to work, we have to find ways to be more efficient with our energy. That's probably job number one. I think the other another area is limiting coal fire generation. And the United States and the EU over the last decade have reduced or removed about 49,000 megawatts of coal fire generation and replaced it with natural gas. So I think the reason that's so important, natural gas may not be the ultimate 2050 silver bullet, but it's 40% less emissions than coal. And I think that's one area that we need to focus on, limiting future coal fire generation in the world, and then making this switch from coal to natural gas. I also think that we need to be very specific in our investments in technology. And three technologies that really jump out to me are nuclear. Once again, the nuclear has been around for decades, and newer technologies with nuclear are happening. The one thing to remember, nuclear energy is the absolutely sole base load. That means 24 hour a day, every day of the year, energy source that is emissions free that we now have on this globe. So that's something that we ought to really consider. There's small modular reactors, newer technologies. That's really key, and fusion versus the current fission technology. The second area that I think are really important for technology is energy storage. Energy storage is the holy grail of the energy transition, basically translating intermittent solar and variable wind into a 24/7 reliable energy source. And I think the third area is technology is air capture for CO2. We got to find ways to make that cheaper. In addition, in tandem with lowering our emissions, we need to address the current base load of energy generation and lower that. So I think those things, along with, I believe in the Pareto principle, the 80-20 rule, focus on the areas that will help to move the needle fastest and most economically toward CO2 reduction. We need to highlight and move on those quicker than other areas that are not as impactful, that don't move the needle for decarb. And finally, I think we need to be really open to new ideas about how to attack the climate problem. Calibrate the performance, like a marginal abatement cost curve. What's the cost to abate per each ton of CO2? And then have an open debate, a fair competition, and let the best ideas win. So I think open discussion is really the key, just as we're having here, sharing ideas, calibrating them, and hopefully moving toward a better solution.
Yeah, I agree. And also, you know, what I've learned is that there's not just one way to solve this problem. You know, different countries have different and better resources. For instance, Kuwait with sunlight can definitely do more solar, where, you know, maybe another country has a different form of energy that would be better suited for them. So Gina, do you have anything to add to that?
I just would like to add the fact that the population growth anticipation is 2.4 billion, which is equivalent to 32% increase in the next 30 years. So this number is too alarming. We just need to ensure that the buildings that will be up and operating are built in line with the right targets, or what we are hearing of as the net zero targets with the right definitions. So I'm mostly involved in decarbonization of the built environment, but I'm also interested in other sectors that I will highlight on as well. But For example, when we talk about the decarbonization of the built environment, it's good to approach both the operational carbon and the embodied carbon. And a design approach for reducing the operational carbon would take into consideration a lean design that reduces the energy consumption, which eventually reduces carbon emission, a clean design that considers various parameters that has to do with the built sector assets, like the orientation and the facade being both optimized to reduce solar gains, a green design that highlights on the fact that all energy is generated from renewable resources, and finally offsetting the remaining carbon that really takes into account calculating the remaining carbon and then offsetting it in a recognized offsetting framework. Now, when we look at the embodied carbon of the built environment, it's important to think of a way or strategy which includes primarily building nothing. It means like critically appraising the existing building stock, building less. So if you have a building, try to maximize and utilize the space in it, building clever using the right smart materials that are EPDs and that are environmental friendly, recycled, and so on. And finally, minimizing waste, and that could be done using prefabrication, for example, to minimize the waste on site. So this is for the buildings that are going to be built. However, we do have much of an existing building, and those need to be retrofitted because we need to enable increasing energy efficiencies. We need to upgrade the existing insulation. We need to fill in the gaps to minimize any leakage and use electric equipment to run on renewable energy. And this is what I'm doing at work lately, is that we're adding additional measures to optimize energy use to include smart energy management systems, because only with smart energy management system, such as efficient lighting, and we can really save on energy and monitor it so that we can do any corrective action if we see a huge demand on energy while the building is being operated. So this is for the build sector. However, the energy sector should also witness major upgrades. So there are lots of coal plants that needs to be phased out. The power plants must be upgraded to increase the energy efficiency as well. The grid must be improved, just like Ron just said, to account for more added renewable energy capacity. We need incentive programs, because only with incentive programs we can encourage proper energy management during peak demand, and so on when it comes to transportation, such as electric vehicle powered by the renewable energy or hydrogen fuel cells and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's me on this question.
Gina, you brought up waste, and I know waste definitely produces a lot of methane. So to what extent does the waste industry in Lebanon hinder the country's carbon neutral goals?
Considering the waste in Lebanon, we look at it as the second largest contributor to CO2 besides the energy. So, and this percentages is 1.9 million tons of CO2 equivalent, and that's based on the USAID Climate Links studies that were done and surveys that were done in our country. So definitely the waste plays a crucial role in the transition to carbon neutrality. And when you mentioned methane, it's important to highlight on the fact that methane has it's different from CO2. It's more powerful greenhouse gas. It's 84 times more potent than CO2 over a 20-year period. And so unlike CO2 and other greenhouse gases, methane emissions represent 11% of the total greenhouse gas emissions. So sustained reductions in methane emissions must be done so that we can keep global warming in check. So when it comes to Lebanon in specific, there in my perspective, because our landfills are huge, they're mountains, and it's toxic, and it's causing people lots of sickness and lots of breathing disorders, and even people are itching and having certain diseases that we haven't seen before, because we don't know how to use, because there's no waste. We can manage our waste. We need to find an integrated waste management, which really involves priority and investment in waste prevention, in reuse and recycling, but also in energy recovery, because I mean, we don't have electricity. We can recover this energy and we can use it to produce electricity. And in material recycling, for example, which is essential in safe treatment of waste that cannot be recycled. So back to the waste energy, it's to me and Lebanon in particular attractive because the waste incinerated, it can be used to produce heat and thus generate electrical power and serve many households that are currently, and as we speak, without electricity. The second approach, in my opinion, would be to use gas recovery methods for landfills and use this gas to also produce electric power, because I'm highlighting on it because I myself lived it. And I think that this will really mitigate the impact of the waste sector and enable the country to better align with the carbon neutrality goals that are out there. In addition, probably we can use the support of food rescue organizations to avoid any food waste and implement household waste education programs, because there are lots of regions within the country that really need awareness. And that's what myself and many volunteers along me work together to do, lots of educational programs, lots of awareness campaigns to students in schools, to teachers, to old people living in countries and not in the city itself, so that they are able to sort the waste, to be able to reuse the food waste if they're planting as and make use of the waste itself and not really shifting it to the landfill and causing more pollution and more methane into the gas.
Hey, Laura, I'd like to add on to what Gina said. I really agree with her. She's spot on. I think this methane gas extraction from landfills, that's really important because as garbage, trash decomposes, it does produce gas in the landfill and eventually it's going to seep out. It's just like water finding its level. It will go up out of the earth and into the atmosphere, which is... what the number she said is right on. It's we have to find ways to eliminate. So I think drilling wells or ways to extract the methane gas in the landfill, using it to produce electricity and to put it in the grid, one very, very good way to solve that problem and generate renewable energy. The other thing is we need to recycle. I think the aluminum, glass, metals, paper, especially the first three, are we have to find a way to develop markets or incent markets for recycling versus producing new aluminum from bauxite. It's a very energy and emissions intensive process, but even metals, we need to find ways to reuse that in a circular economy type of mindset. It's cheaper to recycle than to produce new metals for sure. And I think that's gonna be really important. The other way for areas, the solid waste that has a BTU value, energy value, incinerate it. I know in Copenhagen in Denmark, they have Europe's largest incinerator, really high smokestack, and air quality pollution controls on the emission, but they actually bring trash from other parts of Europe to that site to dispose of it rather than putting it in the landfill and to generate electricity. So I think those things are really important for us to be looking at. Once again, new ideas, improve existing ideas, but don't have a one-use disposal mentality. I think that's going to be dangerous for our globe in the long term.
With that being said, let's kind of transition over to infrastructure. Can we say that infrastructure, including grid lines and building equipment in the U.S., is more eligible for decarbonization than in Lebanon? In other words, what upgrades are needed for the transition towards energy and building decarbonization, Gina?
While the grid in U.S. is certainly more suited for integration of renewable energy and grid management policy than that of Lebanon, which is still in short of sufficient resources for the needed capacity, I do believe that they both have and face certain challenges in energy and building decarbonization. And the grid challenges, I think, I mean, one of the main sources of the uncertainty is the intermittency of solar and wind power. And this problem may be tackled by utilizing the backup power resources, as Ron mentioned, such as green hydrogen and hydroelectricity storage technologies and demand adapted response. And another particular challenge is the installation of distributed energy resources that can feed into the grid. So like the flow in the grid needs to be reversible, and this requires a new infrastructure that will be needed to monitor and control power and avoid overload. So the logistics of managing local suppliers and loads interaction while maintaining the desired voltage and frequency will need to be addressed. And a late study suggested that decentralized renewable energy generation can be actually more suitable in terms of cost and feasibility than the distributed sources, looking at the timeline that we need to meet for climate change mitigation and all the commitments that are out there. And in terms of building equipment, electrification is the target for decarbonization, as we just spoke of. And for example, the use of heat pump instead of furnaces and boilers uses electricity to cool or heat a space more efficiently than the conventional methods. However, the challenge is convincing mass transition of consumers into electric homes, which may require behavioral changes, which conventional consumers may find difficult, because I myself have experienced it once I was really educating people and making them more aware of how they can really reduce their energy consumption in their homes. So technically speaking, additional equipment will be needed to suit all electric buildings to handle the additional load, and namely the main electric panel. So while the research suggests that switching to electrified building offers reduction in running costs on the long run, there will be definitely higher upfront costs for the consumers, and definitely high upfront carbon if we need new equipment and new adjustments to the buildings. But the operation will surely save on energy and save on carbon emissions.
I tell you, I think as we look at a transition in the US anyway for our vehicular fleet, cars, vans, trucks to electric, I looked at the gasoline and diesel demand in the US, and if you transition that volume of, I think 16 million barrels a day to electricity, we would need about 79% more electricity generation in the US to handle that increased electricity demand, along with the same amount of increase in our transmission lines, our distribution lines, and substations. So I think we're almost doubling our electrical infrastructure in the U.S., and I think that's something we can do. It's all technically feasible. There are issues perhaps with right of way, with increasing that infrastructure.
The timeline.
Yeah, but I think it's also the ambition and funding. Are citizens are they going to incur that cost with a higher in electricity tariff? I think that's one thing that we're going to have to look at. I like Gina's comment about hydro. I think energy storage to me is really key. If you had ways to store energy that could be brought in on an off-peak part of the day, part of the 24 hours, maybe overnight, to handle that peak load, now you're making much better use of your transmission infrastructure. So that's where energy storage is so very key, so powerful as a problem solver. But I think having energy storage, hydro, I think it's going to drive people to look at how hard do we make it to get a permit to put a closed system hydro pump storage, meaning you use cheap electricity during the day when the solar panels are producing excess energy and generate at night. I think we have to look at that and say, well, it's not perfect, but I have probably news for a lot of people. It's not a perfect world. And there are costs to doing anything. If you can find a way with energy storage to reduce infrastructure costs, that's probably an investment that will pay, dividends very, very importantly over a course of several decades. And also the idea in tandem with energy storage is demand side management. I think Gina alluded to it, but I think you have to look at the problem from both a supply and a demand standpoint. Right. Yes, we could increase more supply. Let's incent people to use electricity during the day when it's abundant. Hey, 2 cents instead of 25 cents at 7 o'clock in the evening. You give people price signals and time of use rates. You will incent them to do the thing that's best for all the citizenry, not just their back pocket. So I think we need to look at those items to not only just engineering, technical supply, but how to, and I'll use this word gingerly, manipulate demand by giving people a break in price at a certain time and being punitive on price because the energy is very scarce at other times. So
definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, that's it, reducing the peak demand, and it can be done if building operators really they can understand. And you know, we provide guidelines for all building operators. We tell them that if you do this, it will help us reduce energy. Operators should be more aware of how they can manipulate their own consumption. So if they can adjust when the grid energy is consumed to avoid peak energy rates, things will be improved at the level of the energy demand and consumption. And then we can rely more on renewable energy. And that would be a perfect case scenario to reach any net zero target. So definitely what you're saying is of high importance. And we need to highlight on that, especially when it comes to after designing the building, giving it to the operator and having him operate this building and making it as efficient as possible.
Mm-hmm. Good points. You know, a lot with infrastructure, we talk about reliability and resiliency. So I'm just curious, how do reliability and resiliency fit in with decarbonization? Do you think they're complementary or do you think they're mutually exclusive, Ron?
I think it's really key as we move toward this energy transition that we've kind of spoiled people in the fact that whenever you turn the switch on, electricity appears. And we've been spoiled that we can have electricity whenever we want it. And for residential customers, the price is the same every hour of the day. That's not the way energy is generated and priced in markets. It's very fluid, you know, peak price, low price type of endeavor. But I think one thing that we need to do regarding this question is to really look at how we incent changes in demand and still encourage renewable energy supply, but also don't disappoint our customers, our ultimate customers, to say, well, the sun is not shining. I'm sorry, we have no electricity at 11 o'clock for you to watch your movie. We have to find ways to use backup generation or energy storage, but we have to find technologies and strategies that make the new transition of reliability of power to our homes, our industry, look the same as they now look with fossil fuel, with nuclear, coal, gas, hydro, et cetera. And I think in doing that, we have to have a plan B for our energy generation. There are times that we've seen where in Texas a couple of winters ago, we had issues there regarding reliability and not as much resiliency of saying, so what is the plan B if, it's extreme cold and we don't have generation that's available? Well, we don't have a plan B. Well, shame on us for not being better engineers, better business people to say, we got to plan for the worst, hope for the best, rather than just hope things work well without any design analysis, projection of what could go wrong, how do we solve it? So I think this thing, when we go into energy transition, people want the same reliability. They want to know that energy will be there. It may not be the same as the hour before the source, but it will be there. So I think that's one key thing in getting people, taxpayers, voters on board with this energy transition.
Gina, you have a totally different experience living in Lebanon, don't you?
Oh, yeah. unfortunately, that, you know, every time I think of the numbers that are in Lebanon, having no central generated electricity after the fuel shortages we had that forced the two largest power stations to shut down. So, I mean, it's definitely important to ensure that we have a reliable electricity supply and a quality of service, and ensuring a balance between fiscal budget and elimination of any deficit. But it's also important, like, for example, Lebanon contributes to 0.05% of global emissions at more than 25 million metric tons of CO2 equivalent. That's a huge number, in my opinion. Like, many factors contributed to such situation. And it's unfortunate because there is no corrective action, and that has been for the past decade. So for significant carbon reductions, in specific for Lebanon, we need to focus on the energy efficiency side of it. And this could be by boosting the share of renewable energy, because we do have much of land that can, by covering it with renewable energy, we can at least make sure that we have electricity in households that are away from the city. We can upgrade our power generation to have higher efficiencies. I mean, if you are running on equipment that are degraded and that have very low efficiency, you're wasting energy, and this energy is contributing to emissions. So eventually you're contributing to the climate change and to decarbonization. So we need to really have a building thermal standard that our buildings in Lebanon, because, you know, Lebanon has a very nice weather, and this weather can be so helpful when you want to design. You can count on natural ventilation and not count on HVAC systems all throughout the year. And really, if there has been much of work at the level of the ministry itself, the Ministry of Energy and Water, to integrate like various ingredients, including the decrease of technical and non-technical losses, increase in generating capacity to improve the efficiency, increasing the tariff, because, you know, if no money is coming in, then you can't actually renovate, you cannot buy PV panels, you cannot ensure that you have renewable energy. So Lebanon's case is quite different, and it's really unfortunate that we cannot not do anything about it. And we're going through all this climate change all over the world at the global level, and we're experiencing it. We no longer have like the four seasons. We have a comfortable temperature, outdoor temperature, mostly throughout the whole year. But I mean, we're experiencing changes and delta T's that we haven't experienced before. And that's at the level of the electricity. Now I can talk to you more about the transportation. We do not have any major public transportation. Imagine. So imagine that each and every family has more than two cars. I mean, that's a lot. I'm among very few people that to actually conduct carpooling to go to work. And I cannot use my bicycle. I use it when I travel. But when I'm in Lebanon, I cannot use it because I don't have bicycle pathways. So that's too unfortunate. So there's lots of things that can happen. I mean, we still count on our conventional construction techniques. We're not using any type of material that is sustainable because we don't have a market maturity in our country. And mostly the clients within the country itself, they're not aware of the latest technology and the latest EPDs out there. They don't want to learn to choose different manufacturers that offer EPDs. So like, yeah, those are two different sectors. I can add to it another sector that our country relies majorly on, which is the agriculture. I mean, there exists potential of carbon emission reduction through implementing measures that we can do easily by having efficient irrigation, by having plowing and manure management, by conducting training and awareness campaigns to people that are working in this sector. So And I don't know if you were aware of the latest news that happened a few months ago. We had much of fires. So nobody did reforestation. Nobody is really greening again all this landscape, amazing landscape in Lebanon we have all over the mountains. And so it's really a big shame that things are so bad at the level of Lebanon and things are so advanced in other countries. And I really hope that one day I'll be able to contribute to really change and whatever we're all learning together to implement it on the grounds.
That's a good transition into what kind of energy trends are impacting decarbonization. Ron, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would say they're really four major trends that I've seen in the energy and the decarbonization space, Laurie. One of them, we've seen a lowering of utility scale renewable energy production with solar and wind. Every doubling of installed capacity of solar, we've seen a 16% reduction in the price of production of energy price. And the same thing, 14% reduction for wind. But even with that steep decline, we saw an increase in wind just last year. The commodity price increases due to concrete, steel, and clean energy minerals. So we've got to watch that. The second one is what's called the California duck curve. And it's basically the impact that lots of rooftop solar and utility scale solar coming online during the sunny, bright part of the day, how that impacts the grid. And what that does, it means that lower cost baseload plants, gas, nuclear, they like to operate 24 hours a day, every day for a couple of years. Unfortunately, you've had a lowering of price because of the excess energy during the middle part of the day. And I think that's caused some premature closings of plants that are baseload that we need for the post solar part of the day. So I think that's one thing that we in energy trend that is impacting not only supply but will also impact price as the price of energy gets more dear and higher in the off solar hours of the day. The third is the shale gas revolution in the United States and in other parts of the world. But since 2008, we've seen a very decided increase in natural gas production, which has also lowered natural gas prices. It's reduced natural gas price volatility. And then it's also stabilized the U.S. electricity prices and saving almost $480 billion, that's with a B, dollars over that period of time for consumers. And because of the gas substitution for coal, especially in the United States with gas, we've seen over 970 million metric tons of CO2 abated every year. And the last one, I think, as we see higher and higher renewable energy penetration levels, we're seeing an increase in prices. And the two examples that I would offer would be Germany and California. In the case of California, over the last 10 years, the California electricity price, and this is the price that consumers pay, not the production cost. This is at the home, at the industry. That annual rate of inflation of electricity is 3.31%. The rest of the 49 states, it's 0.5%. So one thing that we really need to track is as we get higher and higher renewables, because we have to have backup, at least in California, that state is almost seven times higher inflation rate per year over that last decade due to the real change, which is higher renewable penetration. And it is what it is. And I think people will decide, hey, I would rather pay a higher price to lower our emissions and I'm willing to accept that. And I think that's one area that we're seeing. I don't think it's publicized. I've written several energy articles on LinkedIn and energycentral.com, but I just want to make sure people are looking at this energy transition with their eyes wide open, making sure they know what the good impacts and maybe the not so good impacts of this transition may be.
Yeah, I totally second you. I mean, carbon taxes and carbon pricing, if properly executed, will surely decrease the global CO2 emissions and boost economic growth, and it will surely be in line with the UN SDGs. So yeah, definitely. Thank you for sharing that.
You know, you bring up a really good point with the carbon tax and with, you know, politicians really moving to get us to that carbon neutral by 2050 role. Can transitioning to decarbonization be an immediate thing, or will it take time? And what can we in the energy industry do to help us get that goal met?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. Mm-hmm. I do believe that big companies and strong global players are on their way towards decarbonization. We've seen lots of organizations commit, lots of countries commit. But still, I do believe that challenge persists. And like, for example, developing countries struggle with implementing renewable energy technologies due to high interest rates, currency risks, less robust credit markets, all of which hinder investments. And also we see that globally, the high upfront costs associated with the transition towards this green energy will definitely give rise to dissatisfaction and possible political instability. I mean, this is why measures will be needed to ensure a smoother energy transition, especially for like low-income households. And definitely you have the challenge when it comes to the competition from fossil fuel industries, which will hinder investments to lower carbon in generation. I mean, at the end of the day, they're losing their money, they're losing their business. And while developed countries will upgrade their potential infrastructure and facilitate transition, like less developed nations, when you talk about Africa, for example, and you imagine it won't be as equipped. I mean, either global responsibility should take course to protect such countries, and mass migration will definitely occur due to the detrimental effects of climate change. So yeah, I mean, challenges are out there, and probably they include lack of incentives for investments, which Ron spoke of. We need like lengthy feasibility assessment. We need designers to be on board for such projects. And the results will surely take long duration. And when you ask us about the timeline, I mean, the results in long duration for preparation and major costs for as long as 5 to 10 years, we need like early action. We need to ensure that we're working on a timely transition and we're meeting those commitments. I'm not saying it's impossible. We need to work together. We need to have like a defined strategy. We need to set targets and goals. We need to implement this strategy. And definitely what we need is to track and report our progress, because I mean, only through measuring and monitoring progress, we can adjust when needed. So it is optimistic, but it is doable. So if we really work together and identify all the opportunities and like set interim targets. So yeah.
Hey Lori, I think to kind of build on what Gina said, I'm a real big believer in watch what people do rather than what they say. They're not always aligned perfectly, and I think one thing that we need to do is to calibrate these agreements that are made. In business, when you have a project and say it's a 40% rate of return project, I can, in a well-run business, they're going to audit after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, did it get 40% or 10% or 80% return? And in like manner, when we see these agreements that people sign, you know, with a treaty or agreement, hey, you said you were going to reduce by 30% by 2025. We're looking at the numbers from 2015. You're not even close. You're not even lowering your emissions. You're gaining. And that's one of the things that I think if you audit the Paris Accord, you'll find that promises or maybe hopeful promises were made. But I think if we're really serious, when politicians and leaders say we're going to do this, hold their feet to the fire. You said one thing, you did another. That's not truthful. And we need to audit and calibrate to make sure if you're really serious about this, what measures are you taking rather than just saying to improve our environment and reduce our emissions? And I really believe these targets, the ability to pay for these changes, especially if they're not well-designed, economical, I think you run the risk that you will get voter blowback, that people will say, wait a minute, I was paying 12 cents a kilowatt hour in Denver. Now it's 35 cents. I can use less, but this is painful. And I think to your point, Gina, in developing countries, Africa, and I've worked in Ghana, West Africa.
Yeah.
Price of energy, they can't stand 50 cents or 25 cents a kilowatt hour energy.
Right.
Everything really falls apart for their families and their economy. And I think that's one thing that we need to look at. Everyone is not making $300,000 a year and can afford high energy prices. So
that's for sure. And we're experiencing this today in Lebanon. So, I mean, people are no longer able to commute to work because they cannot afford those energy prices. So I do believe that, like, if we look globally, we do have like challenges and opportunities. We spoke of the challenges, but I mean, there are always opportunities, as you were saying, Ron. So I'm really happy with the client awareness that I'm experiencing lately. I'm happy with the industry engagement, with the collaboration and partnerships. There's definitely increased importance when it came to sustainability certifications. We're seeing those rating system upgrade to newer versions to take into consideration the decarbonization. And we're also, as designers, we're able to challenge the brief and design criteria at a very early stage to account for that. So I think that we need good incentives. We need international strategies, policies, and legislation guidance as well. We need them all on board. And then definitely if we're able to like living up to those commitments and opening your eyes, as you said, Ron, we can do positive changes, even if we didn't meet the commitments fully, we're at least trying our best to meet a better support for a better tomorrow. So yeah.
Wow. I think you both have really shed a light on industry and on politicians and also different areas that we can reduce carbon. But let's talk about the individuals. Let's end on individuals. I can remember being in high school about 14 years ago in my environmental science class, and we had to take a test on what our carbon footprint looked like. And I will never forget it because it really showed just how much carbon one person or one household can produce. So Gina, tell me, how does the carbon footprint of a typical Lebanese household compare to a typical US household?
Well, by the way, I have my website. You can whenever you're free, you can check it out. What I did is I put like all strategies that can be done at the level of households, and I'm accepting questions voluntarily and just to help people understand how they can really rely on renewable energy to operate their houses since they don't have electricity. And then obviously if they don't have much space to have many panels, they have to decrease their energy demand. And so by updating their LED lighting, for example, the lighting to become more sustainable, to have equipment that are, let's say, highly efficient, and the way they can use it to meet their demand and cater for it through renewable energy, that's really important for the environment, for the climate, but also at an individual level to be able to be resilient and actually live a decent life with electricity. Personally speaking, I've been for the past 8 years educating more than 1,000 students along schools all over Lebanon. I also have that on my website about sustainability, sustainability practices, sustainable operating schools. I've been educating people on times when they can actually implement natural ventilation, open the windows, and I've highlighted on various strategies that can be implemented at no cost that can provide productivity, health, comfort to occupants when they're inside the building, because at the end of the day, we're spending more than 90% of our time indoors. And definitely, I played a big role in terms of waste management awareness and recycling. And even my kids, my 3 and 4 year old kids, do imagine they see me sort and they do it themselves. So I think it's about the mentality, and it's what we teach our younger generation that will really affect us and affect our, because you know something, when my son see me do this every single day and then he sees someone else not do it, he finds this someone else wrong and he's the correct one. And that's what we need. We need the younger generation to understand that we shouldn't be buying new things when we have old things that we can reuse. We shouldn't put this demand on a new version resources. So it's really about the mentality of your own carbon footprint. It's you who should really understand that this earth, it's the one earth and the one home that we all have, and we need to really take good care of it. And we need to work together to make it beautiful again. And we don't want to see, I mean, we're all going on vacations. We're all seeing this fog, we're not understanding why is this fog out there, but I mean, the industry, our everyday actions is contributing to this fog that we don't want to see again in our skies. So yeah, I think it depends on every individual, whether he's with a sustainability background or not. It is easy, it's out there. We have the resources online. We have so many people like myself, like Ron, experts and willing to volunteer and support and help without any means. So I think that we should work together and then we will have definitely good results.
Yeah, I tell you, Gina, I know that in Lebanon, the carbon footprint is, I think I saw 4.3 tons of CO2 per person. Yeah. And you're not going to be surprised with this, but the average carbon footprint in the United States is 16 tons. And
that's oh my one God. Of the,
yes, that's one of the highest rates in the world. Yeah. And the average globally is closer to 4 tons. So wow. Do we use energy, a lot of energy in the U.S.? Yes, most definitely. And I think the reason, not the reason for that, but one historical fact is we in the United States, we have been blessed by very low cost, cheap energy. And that's a good thing and a bad thing. Because we have cheap energy, the incentive to conserve, because maybe price of electricity is 12 cents versus 32 cents. I think people are more aligned to conserving if they're paying a higher price. So better project economics to reduce consumption. And I always use this example, when I was with Xcel Energy, which is the electric utility in Denver, Colorado, I developed a solar program, you know, both residential, commercial, and utility. And I gave an update to the Colorado Solar Energy Industry Association. And it was probably going to be a hostile audience because I was the utility. They were trying to promote solar. But one of the first things that I mentioned in my presentation was, how did everyone get to our meeting today? How many people drove their car? Yeah. So many people raised their hand. How many people rode the bus? Mm-hmm. How many people carpooled? How many people say rode the train? And I mentioned that when you look at the distribution of how we got here, the vast majority, we did not use public transportation. We did not carpool. So really, with the decarbonization, and I did not, that was not a term at that point, we are part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Right. So if you want to reduce energy and be renewable, find ways to cut lights off, recycle, aluminum, metals, trying to find ways to look at your energy bill and say, hey, our neighbor is more of an energy miser than I am. I need to find ways to reduce it because he or she is actually showing you can live in the same neighborhood on a lot less energy if you're cautious and you're self-reliant. So I think those things, we have to look at this energy as I can be part of the solution and conserve and do smart things, or I could be part of the problem, which is waste. And wasted energy is a huge factor in our daily life, both industry and residential. Those are things that we have the ability to do. We don't have to wait for the UN or Washington, DC or Ottawa to tell us what to do. We have a fair amount of common sense. Wasted energy is not good for my wallet, nor is it good for the environment. So I think people need to take a little bit more proactive, I'm part of the solution type of attitude. And I think we can get some really, really good results.
Well said. Definitely. I totally agree with you, Ron. Thank you for that.
Well, guys, this has been such an incredible discussion about transitioning to decarbonization. I think you both have some really good perspectives for both general decarbonization and also from building and existing buildings. So thank you so much for coming on. This has been Full of Energy, an AE podcast, and we'll see you next time.